host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for listening, and please remember to subscribe for free today on your favorite platform. My guest today is Kevin Savasco, a public health expert with a concentration in epidemiology. Kevin's career blends health information technology and public health with experience in disease surveillance systems, post-market drug safety, health administrative systems, and health information exchanges. He holds a bachelor's in computer science from George Mason University, an MBA from Virginia Tech, and a master of public health from George Mason University. During his MPH program, Kevin completed a fellowship with the National Association of County and City Health Officials, tackling public health challenges during the COVID-19 pandemic. He's been recognized with the George Mason University College of Public Health Alumni of the Year Award and the Graduate Award for Excellence in Leadership, and was inducted into the Delta Omega National Honor Society in Public Health. Kevin serves on the George Mason University Foundation Board of Trustees and on the board of HOSA Future Health Professionals. Welcome, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much.
Before we dive in, there's one thing I didn't mention during the introduction, and that's that you just completed your PhD. That's a tremendous accomplishment and just in time for the holidays. So congratulations, Dr. Savasco.
Well, thank you. I'm still not used to hearing that. I appreciate it.
I'd love for you to share the story of how you first became interested in public health. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I was working in health IT, so I certainly had an interest. But then one of my colleagues invited me to join the board of the Friends of Patients of NIH. So the NIH has their own hospital and research site in Bethesda, and they explore cures to diseases. And they've done amazing work with HIV and sickle cell. Well, they pay for a lot of the treatments, but you know, there's always things falling through the cracks. We got a request because a mother was under treatment and the husband was up in Bethesda, but they lived in California. Well, NIH didn't pay the rent back home, and they had three boys in high school, and one of them was about to drop out of high school to pay the rent. I was sort of in the middle of my lunch break on a normal business day, and I just started crying. Luckily, we'd raised the money, that's what we do, and we were able to keep them in their house for a few months while they got a more permanent position. And that's the origin of my career pivot, which ultimately ended up here in the PhD.
So it sounds like you were right away drawn in by the human element of public health.
Yeah, you know, you get in the workday and you're just going through tasks, getting things done, and next thing you know, a tear rolls from your eye. You don't forget that.
Unlike traditional healthcare, which focuses on treating individual patients, what makes epidemiology, a scientific discipline within public health, unique is that it studies the causes and patterns of diseases in populations. It looks at social, behavioral, and environmental factors that influence health outcomes at the broader level. So I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the pandemic. And as a brief recap, on March 11th, 2020, the World Health Organization declared the COVID-19 outbreak a global pandemic. On March 13th, 2020, the Trump administration declared a nationwide emergency. 3 years later, on March 11th, 2023, the Biden administration declared the federal COVID-19 public health emergency over. As of August of this year, 2024, the virus has infected more than 700 million people and caused more than 7 million deaths worldwide. That's more deaths than the combined populations of New Mexico, Nebraska, Wyoming, Montana, and Vermont. And it's going to take years to fully understand the deep sociological, educational, psychological, and economic impact the pandemic had on the world. I remember that one of the things that stood out for me while we were in the midst of things is the difference in how people perceive risk. Like when COVID broke out, I was living in an area where the local population was hugely skeptical about what was going on and was resentful about quarantine and even mask wearing. In fact, I got sick with COVID in October of 2020 before the first vaccine was available, despite having done absolutely everything I could to avoid infection. And I remember I was really upset and scared and spent about 2 weeks hoping my symptoms didn't get so bad that I had to be hospitalized. When COVID broke out, did anything surprise you about the disconnect between what public health officials were warning about and how some members of the public were responding, namely disbelieving what they were being told?
Yeah, I think it was sort of the degree that it happened. You know, we're all unique and we all have different experiences, and we know that people perceive us differently. But I was so surprised that what I ended up doing is going back and reading historical accounts of prior epidemics and pandemics. In our lifetime, right, we've seen things come out, diseases, flus, etc., but nothing to the degree that we saw. I'm a smallpox immunized person that helped was part of the eradication. So I started going back, and you start seeing Marcus Aurelius in Rome, the emperor, dead from plague. King Louis XV, dead from smallpox. King Louis V, dead. Queen Mary II, dead. I mean, these diseases affect everyone. So with our reactions, we have to keep in mind as an overall theme that we're all in this together as humans. Let's keep going back to that. Daniel Defoe, the author of Robinson Crusoe, wrote an account based on his uncle and some of his early experiences of what happened in London when the Black Death went through. Rich people fled. You couldn't get a horse out of town. It was like getting a lift after a concert. People were escaping quarantines by beating up the guards. They're selling elixirs. There's dance mania going on. People were firing muskets and cannons and smoking cigars to purify the air. They're using vinegar, which, who knows, spreading dirt on the floor. So, you know, in a time of change, when you get these novel pathogens, we just don't know what to deal with. We're in a situation that's tough, and it takes a while for the scientists to figure out, can you get it from a package that Amazon delivered, or does someone have to sneeze in your face? So it's hard for us to figure out what to do, so we grasp at things and come up with very illogical behaviors. But I think we need to think, let's realize that that's what happens, right? We're all flawed in how we do it, and not pretend that it's just a matter of presenting evidence to everyone.
I think that's such an important point. What you just shared really humanizes the various reactions we saw not just in the United States, but around the globe. I mentioned that I got COVID in the fall of 2020. And when that happened, I was living in an apartment building with, of course, as luck would have it, an ancient ventilation system. And I'm convinced that I got COVID that way. Respiratory pathogens like COVID are easily spread indoors. So what does that mean in terms of public health, addressing the need to design new buildings differently and retrofitting older buildings?
So I think the overall point that public health brings to this is when you look at our health in general, 60% of it is due to the zip code we live in. So if you're in an area with poor ventilation in your buildings, poor filtering, you know, if you've got good ventilation, you can adjust the flow rates, you can adjust the filters and things like that. But if it's just, you know, ventilation across the building, that's a major infrastructure upgrade. Even though we view ourselves as our individual will and ability to avoid disease or to recover from it, you know, a lot of our health is dependent on our surroundings, and we need to think of each other and the situations we live in. You know, we're all dealing with stress every day, just trying to, you know, pay the rent and keep the food on the table. Sometimes I think we lose track of that we are a society, we are a collection of humans, especially the ones nearest us, and the infrastructure that we ask the government to put in place or put regulations in for buildings. I remember going down to Florida and Hurricane Andrew in 1993 devastated the Southeast. And after that, they put a lot of building codes in, which was helpful. But that was an infrastructure change that was driven by regulations. And I think we're running into a counter-regulation environment going forward. So that is a little concerning.
So that leads me to the next thing, which is that arguably one of the hardest things to do is to get financial support for public health preparedness, because if things are going really well, then it's largely invisible. How can we keep people, particularly legislators, for example, who control the financial purse strings, and ordinary citizens, focused on prevention when many believe that if you don't see it yet, it's not a problem? People have a tendency to be reactive instead of proactive.
You see that narrative in pop culture, like if you look at Men in Black, this secret group that prevents Earth's destruction, or even The Incredibles, right? A kids movie that, you know, these superheroes who get no respect and no credit. So I think as humans, we understand that narrative. But when you bring it to reality, a friend of mine wrote a book and it was interesting. She cited that politicians get rewarded for reacting, not for preparing, like as far as their election. This is a hard one. And if you look at, you know, diseases in the past, you look at smallpox, it's with you. After you had smallpox, if you survive, you've got pockmarks on your face. So if you're a child growing up, you're walking around your community, you know, even 10, 15, 20 years later that something happened. With some of these respiratory diseases, you don't see it. People pass away and they're gone. It's sad we miss them, but it's not visually the same. We've seen in a lot of these historic studies that the risk perception drops after a while. the disease will come through, there'll be an outbreak, there'll be an epidemic, instant risk panic, and then it starts to drop off. So I think this is human nature, and it's built into how we elect and select our leaders. So although the politicians, I think, are ultimately in the front of it, you know, how do we, you know, use maybe narratives and keep that in top of mind and translate that into preparedness? I think there's also pressure, you know, when there's budget austerity, is preparedness waste? You know, I think we've been worrying about avian flu for 15 years now. You know, what's the difference between crying wolf, oh, the avian flu's coming, versus we're actually been trying to avoid it for the last 15 years successfully? Can some of these story narratives be brought into it and not just deal with it in facts?
We're experiencing a resurgence in preventable diseases like measles, diphtheria, and polio because vaccine rates are declining. And that's partly due to the challenges of maintaining pediatric vaccination rates during the pandemic, but also due to mistrust about vaccines caused by misinformation and disinformation. So what are your thoughts about why misinformation about medical topics, particularly vaccines, is so pervasive today?
If you go back 1,000 or more years ago in Eastern Asia, when smallpox was going on, somebody figured out if you took scabs or other material from someone who had a mild case and intentionally infected someone by perhaps blowing the powdered scabs into their nose. Seriously, this is what they did. They would do this because if the smallpox hit, 30% of your village would be wiped out. But if you do it as a community, you avoid a 30% death rate. So, you know, I'm not saying that there's no risk in today's vaccines, but it's thousands more percent chance less of getting something wrong. And if it is, it's usually mild and there's compensation for those who aren't. But if these diseases like measles run wild, brain damage, blindness, deafness, but we don't see it because we are successful in dealing with it. So I'm afraid there's going to be this oscillation where you never quite eradicate it like smallpox. But I'm afraid that if they start pulling back even more so on the vaccines with the incoming administration, I think it's going to be self-correcting, but in a very tragic way.
A lot of what we're talking about here is also the question of trust and knowing who to trust, what to trust. So what steps can public health experts and organizations take to rebuild trust with skeptical communities? Because there's plenty of folks out there who just don't know what to believe anymore.
And if you end up in a pandemic and you want to push the vaccination to deal with it, you're bringing in the history of mistreatment in the medical system, either through unethical experimentation or just going to the doctor and not having your symptoms or your pain taken seriously. So these communities are coming into the medical system with a history of distrust, and now it's urgent to try to convince them to get vaccinated. So we need to address overall distrust with the pharma industry as well. There's amazing work they do, and the drugs are tremendous, and they bring good health. But, you know, they've also been accused of patent evergreening, where they'll just churn drugs to try to keep the patent alive, to keep monopolies. So it's not like everyone is evil or all companies are evil. It's not a simple one or the other issue, but got to address the overall trust. There's a certain percent, I think, of the population that isn't getting vaccinated that may have grown up in an environment where they weren't able to trust people. So they're, I think, going to be the hardest ones to reach, because do you need to address those sort of issues through therapy before you can even get to it? And investing resources to try to get them vaccinated is difficult because there's only so much money we have into communications and campaigns. Where do you focus it? So I think the inequities we see, some of the distrust is driving it. When I get vaccinated, the next day, I usually feel tired. My immune system kicks in. You know, I don't think we explain that well enough that it's okay. It's perfectly normal. I usually do it on a Friday and then, you know, Saturday watching sports. But I think we're so busy trying to get people vaccinated, we need to be a little bit more thoughtful and going, hey, it's not a perfect day. You'll end up probably being tired. And some of the day laborers, in talking to some of the folks at county level, they have gone out to some of the sites for the day laborers and who tend not to work just one day a week, maybe on Sunday. They'll go, hey, why don't you get vaccinated on this day, because they're not anti-vaccination, but they can't trade off the income. But if you work with them and talk to them about this is what will happen, this is the benefits for you as far as not missing work by having vaccination.
So you're also talking about meeting people where they are.
Yes. Yes, very much so. A lot of my dissertation was focused around trying to bring marketing aspects into public health communications around psychographics. A lot of what people believe and what they think and feel. So you start with that. Don't necessarily start with, okay, they're in a age group that's vulnerable or could have bad outcomes. Let's just start with how you're feeling and what you're thinking, and we'll work from there.
So let's say somebody is interested in educating themselves about healthcare issues such as vaccines. What people usually do these days is go online. online? That's the first thing. Are there any specific red flags to look out for when evaluating medical information online? For example, how can someone who isn't medically trained determine which sources of medical information are trustworthy? How can people differentiate between legitimate expertise and pseudo-expertise in online content?
Yeah, so a lot of the big health systems like Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, even your local hospital system or your local health department, they're going to be a little dry, a little bit clinical, but their accuracy on them is going to be pretty good. And assuming that you have insurance will get you to the point where you can hopefully have a more productive conversation with your doctor or even know which doctor to go to. The issue happens, and we've seen this in the direct-to-consumer advertising in pharma, where pharma will try to advertise for a drug, and the intent of those is to point the patient to the doctor to have a conversation. But what happens is the research shows some people go online, and while they're looking online for information, the search engines will start throwing up these alternative sites in front of them. And now, even though pharma's trying to direct them to a path to get good advice from their doctor, they kind of get sidetracked. There's a lot of advice, like MITRE's got a great misinformation center, but there's a lot of advice around like fact-checking and checking the sources, but that can get exhausting. So I think my advice in general, when you look at and you see something pop up in social media, how do you feel after you've read it or seen it or heard it? Are you angry? Are you scared? Are you mad? If you've gotten emotional as a result, you should probably start thinking that's probably misinformation. And typically they will scare you about a vaccine or a treatment or an agency or a person. So as soon as you see some of those things, you should back away. Please don't share it like immediately, especially when you're emotional. And that happens to me too. I mean, I can read these things and get upset. I won't share them, but you know, that's what they're meant to do, and they're really good at it. And if you start sharing, especially like in your group, if you're a mom in a parents group talking about kids, or an alternative medicine group having a reasonable conversation, if enough percentage of those conversations turn towards misinformation, that whole group can tip. So by sharing misinformation, it's not just you having shared it, but you can influence a whole group just by adding top of a pile, and everyone can flip over. Good health communications will put a little bit of concern in, but about the disease. Adding a little sense of urgency to the message about, you know, the risk of the flu is great, but the messages will also contain efficacy and instruction. So if it's a nice, well-placed message about, hey, you should be a little bit concerned about this disease, and here's a little bit about the treatment or prevention, and here's what you do. So again, fear of the treatment, fear of a person, fear of an agency, don't share it, kind of back away, maybe step away, and then re-engage with your doctor or with some of these other well-known, you know, medical system or your local health department. I know there's some distrust of those, but honestly, you really need to start there because they will describe the disease and get you to someone who can help you.
Right, rather than just some random influencer out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's foreign governments that are pushing that information, and you might unknowingly, you know, be sharing information.
I was reading an article that the University of Chicago Medicine released a couple of months ago titled Health Information on TikTok, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. And it noted that a lot of the medical information shared by non-medical influencers on TikTok is not true. Big surprise, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the type of stuff that we want to stay away from. Somebody who is really trying to get people all emotionally jacked up.
Yeah. And if we're concerned about pharma making money and doctors making money and whoever are making money, some of those influencers do. I mean, they sell gummies and other products and such. They may have, you know, some ulterior motives or some other conflict of interest involved.
While you were earning your PhD, you explored how to use marketing and advertising to gain support for vaccine adoption. And I do want to share the title of your dissertation, which is Segmenting Populations by Risk Perception Attitude Framework to Support Vaccination Update Social Marketing. That is a mouthful. Can you tell us about your findings and share any examples of strategies that might help strengthen public support for vaccines?
Yeah. So when I started the program, my advisor, Dr. Rowis, asked me, she says, I'm interested in you because you came from business and from tech. Why can we sell Coke around the world and we can't convince people to be vaccinated? Coming from having to live in the sales world before in tech, you can't just, you know, call the entire world and go, hey, I want to sell technology to you or sell services to you. You got to pick your markets. You got to take the resources you have and apply them appropriately. Who's willing to buy from you? Who will never buy from you? Who may be interested? Who may not? So you need to break down those markets and segment them. What I kept seeing is, regardless if it was a tetanus vaccination, influenza vaccination, HPV vaccination, COVID vaccination, and all these studies I kept reading, risk of the disease, the percentage perception of the risk of the disease and the perception of efficacy of the vaccine, always up top, always up top. There's some other things, age and things that would appear. Well, it turns out someone was ahead of me, and that's the risk perception attitude framework. So basically dividing high perception, low perception, and you get this 2x2, and epidemiologists, we love our 2x2 table. Then coming from the business side or social marketing, what do those groups look like? Can I find differences between those groups? And as it turns out, that high risk perception, high vaccine efficacy is exactly who you expect it is, right? Great verbal skills. You know, they want to vaccinate not just for themselves, but for the world. You know, they're open to information. They're very trustful, right? And they're highly vaccinated. So pretty much you just need to tell them, hey, you know, show up at the pharmacy at 4 o'clock on Friday. And they're like, I will be there. So they're easy to market to, right? So if you break them off in a little group, simple marketing, yeah. And then there's the low risk perception, high efficacy. That was an apathetic group. So we looked at the data from the summer after the vaccines came out, not terribly worried about COVID, not really anti-vax, but not a lot of reasons to get vaccinated. It was mostly about personal benefit. So it's like, how do you get them going? They tended to be younger. So were they less at risk? Sure, but they could spread it to others. But typically vaccine campaigns have not addressed those people. So there's nothing to go from, right? Is there maladaptive coping? Is there needle fear, right? Are there, what is in that group, I think, going forward that we can look at to talk to? You know, can we work with the pharmacies? Like, hey, while you're coming in to buy your cereal, you know, they do some of that already, but if we can tell a little bit more about what those groups look like, that might help. And one of the most interesting groups was the high risk, low efficacy. And that's where we found a lot of mental health issues, a lot of chronic health issues. They were your front line key workers, more religious, somewhat distrustful, but they were open to information. What we recommended in my dissertation was doctors are really good at convincing people, hey, you need to get vaccinated. And a lot of these folks in that group were also depressed, not really cognitively processing the information. So you could give them as much information as you want. And you know, when you're freaking out, when you have high anxiety, depression, most of us have been there, right? You're just not listening. You're not managing the information. Your doctor just goes, hey, Kevin, while you're here, right, coming in for your blood pressure check, trust me, we want you to get you vaccinated that way, right? You won't have to deal with it later. And you're like, fine. So how you talk to these different groups so we can create campaigns.
Well, obviously, there are a lot of lessons that we can take with us forward, but we do have a new administration coming into the White House in 2025. And with that, new leadership at the CDC, the FDA, and HHS. What implications might the appointment of individuals with controversial health views, and I'm stating that very delicately, have for the overall credibility of public health institutions? And how will the new administration shape the direction of public health policy, not just in the U.S., but also globally?
So in U.S., I think one of the most important things to start with public health is Constitution Amendment 10 basically says anything that's not in the Constitution falls to the states. And that's where public health falls. So even though you're going to get a lot of appointees at the federal level and they control a lot of resources, you should probably pay attention to what your state's going to do because they run their health departments, they run their Medicaid and such. And there's a lot of things the feds do from an economy of scale to make things move faster that they could slow down and make things more difficult for the state. So if you did have a state that did want to maintain their current vaccination policy posture, that's great. They might be slowed down. If you're in a state where the feds are cutting back on vaccinations and your state is, you should be concerned. You should be watching for outbreaks. So if you look at measles, there's something called R-naught. Try not to get too techie, but basically if we were in a room full of a lot of people and I had measles, I would give it to 12 to 18 people just by being in the room. It'll hang in the air for hours if they're all unvaccinated. That's how dangerous these are. And then the issue is there, if those 18 people get sick, a bunch of them will go to the hospital. The hospital can't take it. Okay. They'll get sick from a bacterial infection. We don't have enough antibiotics. I mean, so it just cascades. And that's why as public health, we're so forceful in talking about vaccinations, because imagine you're in a seesaw and you move that point where he goes back and forth 90% of the way over. That's where we need to be for these vaccinations. The viruses are so heavy in a weight that to balance it, you really need to have 90% of your population vaccinated. And we're already dropping through the state policies lower and lower and lower. I think it will be self-correcting because you will start seeing more pertussis outbreaks, more measles outbreaks, and people will start realizing, okay, maybe this wasn't the right thing. It'll self-correct.
But at what cost? At what cost to people who are trying to protect themselves or try and protect children, for example, who really don't have a political say in things?
Oh, a tragic cost. And pathogens, by the way, don't belong to a political party. They don't care, right? When that virus hits you, they don't care anything about you, what your political leanings are, what religion you are, how old you are, where you grew up. They're just going to infect. assuming the availability is still good, get vaccinated, get your family vaccinated. If there's people in your family who don't want to, right, have a good, honest conversation with them, get them to their doctor, try to convince them. From an emotional health perspective, you got to try to figure out what you can control. I carry a mask with me. I don't always wear it on the plane, but for example, I was at an airport the other day and a fire broke out and I smelled like an electrical fire coming out. And I was stuck at a bus stop, pulled my mask out. If I'm on a plane and a lot of people are coughing, I'll put it on. I do get vaccinated. I do wear a mask in certain situations, you know, where I want to stay healthy, but control what you can control and then just trust that, tragic as it is, that might be the cycle we have to go through. And in public health, we need to be ready. How are we going to pick up the pieces to correct it again quickly? We're upset that it might happen, but at some point, what control do we have to stop it when we've tried through the electoral process, through the communications process, right? We'll do what we can do. But as we've seen from history, right, people are going to behave how they're going to behave.
We were talking about how to deal with vaccines from the individual level, people who are concerned about what's happening around them. But what about the health experts? Like, how do they appropriately navigate the tension between political directives and scientific integrity under a politicized administration? That's what it looks like we're going to be dealing with for several years. How do we protect public health there and make sure we get the word out without alienating or further pushing away people who are already not sure what to believe?
In the next administration, I always try to break apart what is a soundbite, what is fear, uncertainty, and doubt, right? What is the reality TV angle of it that is just meant to perpetuate this discomfort and upset that we have because it's easy for politicians and bad actors to get away with things while we're all upset, pointing to somebody who we don't like. Although we do see a lot of that going on now, it's all conjecture until they come into office. So what I say is, let's just keep an eye out and look at the policy level and figure out what's going on. What are they actually trying to change versus what is just hyperbole and sort of social media hype? And let's deal with it at that level. And within that, I guess a couple areas of concern I have are in the Affordable Care Act. If you look at the states that did not implement it, you've got a high rate of medical bankruptcy in the people, the citizens in that state. You also have high level of disability, and you also have a lot of hospital closures. So I'm concerned that those hospital closures will continue and the healthcare infrastructure will drop, which is not what the voters expect. If that's the case, you drop the insurance rolls, that's what's going to happen. Also, similarly, on the Medicare side, if indeed they do push more seniors onto Medicare Advantage, that costs the government more. And as we've seen from the recent murder of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, there's a lot of frustration in, you know, not paying bills and not covering procedures. So I think we're leaning into an insurance world where typically this incoming administration will rely on, you know, commercial practices. But when you look at health, right, it doesn't really follow a commercial model well. The healthier the population is, the less healthcare costs, and we're becoming a less healthy population as we go. So I'm concerned about the delivery healthcare infrastructure, both Medicare and Medicaid in general, especially in some of the more rural areas.
Let's talk about community leadership, specifically cultural or religious leaders. They are usually people who are respected and listened to at the local level. Is there anything that they can do to encourage recommendations to follow medically based public health advice?
Public health about 10 years ago started reemphasizing partnership. They'll probably find friends in their local health department and in the local health system if they can bring a description of like who is in their audience, who listens to them, who's sort of under their cultural care. Because I think sometimes we try to partner, but not knowing, right, where the reach of those people are. If you can do it thoughtfully and engage and say, hey, I've got my church group or my community group, and we are concerned, and you bring the voice of those people, then bringing that mass of people to the public health and the health organizations, I think helps create links and helps create grander programs versus just one-on-one individual interactions.
That's really good to know.
Yeah, there are some tremendous community leaders who just do not get recognized. You know, as we mentioned, the Men in Black and the Incredibles, you know, there's those heroes out there who, you know, we just don't hear about them enough.
With the potential of a weakened public health infrastructure, although I did hear what you said, which is let's wait and see and let's not jump the gun before we know what's going to happen. How might the U.S. prepare for future health emergencies such as pandemics or bioterrorism threats?
So there, I think the more we help people understand, you know, there's been talks about cutting the CDC budget, but 70 or more percent of that CDC budget pass this through to the states. And those states rely heavily on that money for their public health infrastructure. So if we just decide, hey, we're going to cut money to save money, you know, not realizing that, you know, it's going to you, right? It's not going to some person you don't like in a government office sitting, you know, in a certain state. It's going to you and to your health department. Making sure that we all understand where that money goes is probably a place to start, because maybe it would be less likely to be cut. And I know a lot of the medical associations are probably actively lobbying and conversing with the new administration. So, you know, more power to you, you know, please do that. The other, I think, area that's been investment in the last few years after COVID has been on the technology data infrastructure. So there's a lot of investment in collecting data from the hospitals, some innovative work in collecting samples from the sewage systems. So you get an idea of what's going on in the community. So it'd be great if those continued. And I think there is some language that that will be supported going forward. So that's good. But again, we'll see what happens. And also keep in mind, Congress appropriates and the administration runs the program. So Congress could continue to support these programs, even if the incoming administration says publicly that they don't. So let's continue to work with our congresspeople and our senators and ask for support, knowing that a lot of that money does come back to you. That Medicare money comes back to your local doctor. The public health money comes back to your local health department. Even though it goes to the feds, a lot of it comes back locally. And I think we need to admit that.
What are the next steps that you're going to be doing for the public health field?
I'm moving on to help clinical trial recruiting issues. You know, a lot of times we invest money as health to try to figure out, does this treatment work? Does this pill work? Does this bed net prevent malaria? But the way the studies work, we don't recruit enough people or they don't stay in the trials. So trying to help figure out, what does that mean? Can we make that work better so we got better evidence? And you started out describing epidemiology. When you go to your doctor and they tell you what the treatment is, a lot of that advice comes from chemists and pharmacists and epidemiologists all sitting looking through data with medical doctors trying to figure out, when this is the condition, this is a recommendation. So I'll kind of be back into that area. I think it's a good fit because a lot of the prevention work I did on vaccinations, all the psychology around it, the psychographics around it, trying to recruit people to trials, same thing, right? How do you encourage someone to come in and join a trial when maybe they don't have an acute illness right now?
Well, you can start an Instagram account for that and then throw out a couple of reels and things like that. Dr. Savasco encourages you to sign up.
So you mentioned that TikTok article before. I did read through that, and I think there's good lessons for public health communicators in there. When you look at the recommendations on how these TikToks get attention, right? The fonts they use, the music they use, all the little flash and glam and pops that they use, you know, including that in public health to the right audiences. Yes. I mean, I don't think I'd splash that in front of, you know, every person in the country, but if you know what a TikTok audience is and why they're looking for it, right? Hey, let's talk to them in their language, the way they're used to seeing it.
I think you and I should talk after the recording is done.
Okay. I dance poorly, just FYI.
So how can people get in touch if they're interested in learning more about your work?
I'm most active on LinkedIn. That's the easiest place to find me.
Well, Kevin, thank you so very much for having taken the time today. You've really shared invaluable advice, and looking forward to seeing you make a difference out there in the world.
Appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.